Charles Dickens. The boy was barely 12 years old. He was thin and pale, as children who seldom see the out-of-doors are. His clothes were worn and stained, and his shoes, with barely any sole left, should have been discarded months ago. But in spite of his ragged and thin appearance, there was a certain sturdiness about him. His eyes were unusually bright and intense, and his face, although glum, reflected a kind of determination. There were jars before him, endless stacks of them, each containing black shoe polish. His task was simple and unbearably tedious. On each jar, he was to paste a label. Jar after jar, hour after hour, he pasted these labels on the same wooden table in a damp, noisy warehouse in the heart of the London slums. There were other boys who worked at his side, some older, some younger. And there were still others in other warehouses. They worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, sweeping, assembling, polishing, stacking, or loading. Beyond the warehouses, beyond the dirty, smoggy district of London's factories, there were different boys, boys who went to school and studied, who rode in fancy carriages and ate roast beef and dumplings for dinner, who played with spinning tops and toy soldiers, and were tucked into bed under puffy quilts by fragrant, adoring mothers. But young Charles Dickens was not among them. In the warehouse, a shrill whistle announced the lunch break. It was the same meal as yesterday and the day before, a lump of raisin pudding and a penny loaf of bread. He took a dirty rag and tried to rub the sticky paste and the black dye from his fingers. He paid no attention to the rat that darted out from beneath the table. He was used to them. There were 4 more hours to go, and then he could go home. Home was now a stark room in the attic of a cheap boarding house close to the warehouse. As he ate, he wondered, as always, what would become of him. He thought about his parents and whether he would ever see them again. It occurred to him, with desperate fear, that he might be orphaned forever. What could not have occurred to him was that this miserable experience of abandonment and poverty would later be the inspiration for some of the greatest stories in English literature. Today, Charles Dickens' books are known to almost everyone in the Western world. The dejected young boy who once labored for a blacking warehouse would later produce works that are famous for their vivid descriptions of the social conditions of mid-19th century England. They're famous, too, for their deep pathos, pathos Dickens experienced firsthand. Dickens was born in England on February 7, 1812, the second of 8 children. He was born just in time to witness the transformation of England from a rural agricultural society to a commercial industrial society of factories, slums, and the rising middle class. It is this change which is so powerfully chronicled in his novels, and which makes them not just dramatic stories, but social histories. Dickens' own family was middle class, but barely middle class. His background included one grandfather who was a servant and one who was an embezzler. His father, a Navy clerk, made a decent salary but was careless with money. When he was imprisoned for debt, young Charles was yanked out of school and sent to the blacking warehouse to make his own living. It was such a significant and terrible event in his life that 60 years later he could still barely talk about it. At the time, he was both consumed with shame and with fear and resentment that his parents had deserted him. The warehouse period was brutal but short. Dickens' father soon came into an inheritance, and he was put back into school. His mother protested, preferring he keep his job at the warehouse, and Dickens harbored bitterness over this for many years. The inheritance, too, was soon spent, and the Dickens family was never more than a few pence away from poverty. This poverty would haunt Dickens the rest of his life, even when he himself was wealthy. In one of his first books, David Copperfield, he wrote a formula that showed exactly what he felt about the power of money. It went, annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19.6. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, aught and six. Result, misery. Back in school, Dickens used to write stories on scraps of paper and sell them to his schoolmates for marbles. But writing at this point was a pastime. At 15, when it came time to think about a trade, he went to work in a law firm as a clerk. Later, he became a court reporter, first of law cases, then of parliamentary proceedings. He was a fast and hard worker, known for his astute observation. Next, Dickens moved on to journalism. The skill he picked up there was his ability to meet grueling deadlines. Around this time, in his early 20s, Dickens fell in love with a young woman named Maria Beadnell. But his proposal of marriage was rejected. Maria found his family and his future prospects unsatisfactory. Again, he had to confront feelings of dejection and inferiority. But this time, there was a positive effect, too. Dickens became determined to succeed and to prove himself. After this, Dickens began writing comic sketches under the pseudonym he's now famous for. They were called Sketches by Bowes. He was inspired to choose Bowes by the way his brother pronounced the name Moses when he had a cold. In 1836, when he was 24, Dickens wrote the serialized novel The Pickwick Papers, and suddenly he was famous. At the same time, he became editor of a monthly magazine in which he began serializing Oliver Twist and later Nicholas Nickleby. Dickens was a man of enormous energy, and he never worked on just one project at the same time. Sometimes he had as many as three or four going. People who met him always commented later on two things: how long and hard he worked, and what a congenial conversationalist he was. Dickens rose every day at 7 and took a cold bath. Then he wrote until lunchtime, using blue ink and a goose quill pen, and blue-gray paper. He had all his little rituals, like many writers do. Every object on his desk had to be in exactly the same position each day before he could begin writing. Every afternoon he took walks, long walks, sometimes 20 or 30 miles at a time. He strolled the streets of London, which he came to know intimately, often with his dogs trotting along behind him. These walks were essential to his creative process. He found it hard to work without them. While he walked, he worked out plots, developed characters, and found inspiration for new settings and stories. Then he returned home for more writing. His son once said that even in his creative work, no city clerk was ever more methodical or orderly than Dickens. He wrote with punctuality and business-like regularity. Dickens shared the Protestant ethic that most of his readers held, and which motivated the lower and middle class of Victorian England. That ethic was based on industriousness, hard work, and sobriety. It held that financial and social success were earned through tireless effort and prudent behavior. At the end of David Copperfield, Dickens' most autobiographical novel, the hero says, "Whatever I have tried to do in life, I have devoted myself to do well. Whatever I devoted myself to, I have devoted myself to completely. In great aims and in small, I have always been thoroughly in earnest." After a day of hard work at his desk, Dickens liked to relax at night. In the evenings, he played 20 questions or charades, retiring for bed at about midnight. He couldn't sleep unless his bed was placed in a north-south position. He had other rituals and superstitions, too. He touched certain objects 3 times for luck, and always believed that Friday was his lucky day. He was drawn to the occult and the macabre, and liked to attend seances, murder trials, and public hangings. The same year Pickwick Papers was published, when he was 24, Dickens married Catherine Hogarth, the daughter of a respected Scottish journalist. The marriage started out well enough, with Dickens referring to her by the pet names Mouse and Dearest Pig, but it deteriorated over the years and eventually became a source of great distraction and despair to him. In fact, by the end of the marriage, he was calling her by the not-so-pet name Donkey. Catherine was supposedly a nice enough woman, but not nearly as intelligent as Dickens. She was said to have no interest in and no understanding of the artistic temperament. Friends said she was a good woman, but rather whiny. Dickens himself said that only 2 years into the marriage, she displayed peculiarities of temperament and even mental disorders, and that he agreed with her own statement that she was unfit for the life she had to lead as his wife. One can assume that living with Dickens had its challenges, too, but Catherine Dickens never spoke about her marriage, so we're left with the one-sided view of her husband. To complicate matters further, somewhere along the line, Dickens developed a strong attachment to his wife's sister, Mary. When she died prematurely, he plunged into grief more befitting a husband than a brother-in-law. About 20 years into his marriage, Dickens also fell in love with a young actress named Ellen Ternan, whom he met in one of the many amateur theatrical productions he liked to involve himself in. In 1856, when he was 44, he wrote to a friend, "I find the skeleton in my domestic closet is becoming a pretty big one." Ellen Ternan, who was 27 years younger than Dickens, was said to be quite pretty, intelligent, but not especially talented. Most people believe that Dickens used Ellen as the inspiration for many of the heroines in his later novels, the ones who tended to be lovely, angelic, adoring, and generally perfect. 2 months after he met Ellen in a play called The Frozen Deep, he wrote to a friend, "The domestic unhappiness remains so strong upon me that I can't write and can't rest 1 minute. I have never known a moment's peace or content since the last night of The Frozen Deep." When he was 46, Dickens finally separated from Catherine. It caused a scandal with his friends and family, but not with the public. It seems Dickens and Ellen Ternan were lovers up until his death, although there is no way to confirm this. After he died, she married a clergyman and helped him direct a school. In spite of the difficulties in his marriage, Charles Dickens managed to father 10 children, 9 of whom survived. He loved his home and his family life and even considered writing a cookbook for a while. His children said he was a delightful father, at least when they were young. Like many parents, he had problems with his children in adolescence and later in life complained that they had worried and disappointed him. Dickens was always proud of his houses, particularly his last house called Gad's Hill Place. It was the same estate his father had often pointed out years before, with the comment that it was the type of place Dickens himself might own someday, if he would only work hard enough. In one of his houses, Dickens installed a secret door to his study, which he made to look like a set of bookshelves. It was filled with dummy books that had fictitious titles Dickens had much fun inventing. They included 5 Minutes in China, The Quarterly Review, Noah's Architecture, and Cats' Lives, which consisted of 9 volumes. There was also an amusing pair of bogus books entitled The Wisdom of Our Ancestors and The Virtues of Our Ancestors. The Wisdom of Our Ancestors contained volumes on the block, the stake, the rack, and dirt. The Virtues of Our Ancestors was so slim the title had to be printed sideways. Dickens was very sociable and liked to have guests, most of whom were friends from art and literature circles. He went out frequently, especially to the theater, and always dressed very elegantly. In fact, he was quite vain. He was particularly concerned about his hair and often pulled a comb out, even at dinner parties, to make sure every hair was in place. He wore red velvet waistcoats, rings on his fingers, and a diamond stick pin on his vest. He once said of himself, "I have the fondness of a savage for finery." This by no means should imply that Dickens was superficial or that he turned into a snob. To the contrary, he always avoided high society, and he dedicated himself to many important social causes. Even while writing novels, editing journals, producing amateur plays, and giving public readings, he found the time and energy to help the underprivileged. He founded and for many years directed a home for reformed prostitutes, and he lobbied for slum clearance, sanitation, and educational reform. As his life progressed, he became more and more concerned with urban issues and established himself as perhaps the first great urban novelist. When he was 41, Dickens began to give public readings of his works, originally for charity and to distract him from his marital unhappiness. He had always loved theater, and his readings were just that. Theater! He poured immense amounts of energy and emotion into his readings, so much that his friends wondered about the effect on his health. Dickens performed 471 times, and his most popular readings were always the same two: The Trial from Pickwick, and The Christmas Carol. The audiences were moved to tears and laughter, and they loved him. His readings became so popular that one American tour earned him $100,000 in only 6 months, an astronomical sum for the time. But his friends had been right. The reading tours were so exhausting, they eventually sapped his strength and hastened his end. It became harder to stay ahead of his deadlines, and he complained of insomnia and exhaustion. His nerves had been unsettled ever since a railway accident in 1865. He undertook his very demanding tour of America in 1867, and it was here his energy began to fail. Although his readings were as vigorous as always, friends noticed he'd aged considerably on the tour, and that his health deteriorated from then on. He wrote at the time, "I am nearly used up." He was also disenchanted in America. He'd been excited about visiting the Republic of his imagination, as he called it, but he found it vulgar and was happy to turn home. At home, his health remained precarious, and he restricted his social activities. He canceled a tour for 1869 after he had a collapse and turned himself instead to a new novel and a series of short readings in London. These readings ended with the famous speech, "From these garish lights I vanish now forevermore," words that were printed less than 3 months later on his funeral card. Dickens died of a stroke on June 9, 1870, at the age of 58, and was buried in Poets' Corner at Westminster Abbey. For months later, thousands of people came to visit his gravesite. If there was a love affair in Dickens' life that mattered the most, it was his love affair with his public. His relationship to his readers was possibly closer than that of any other author. In fact, it's been said that what he really died of was popularity. When he appeared to speak, he was mobbed, just like movie stars are mobbed today. People tore at his clothing and tried to touch him. During breaks in his readings, he would sit down and eat a dozen oysters with champagne to regain his energy. Dickens always wrote with the goal of wide readership, and his fans ranged from the poor and barely literate to the aristocratic, although the bulk of his readers belonged to the middle class. One reason he loved to give readings was that people who couldn't read could hear his stories instead. Dickens aimed to please all his fans, but also to stir their conscience. He was able to write about social ills by using comedy and melodrama to make them more palatable. He created some of the most comic and eccentric characters in literature. Their humorous habits and quirky names delighted his fans. Names like Mr. Pecksniff, Martin Chuzzlewit, and Wilkins Micawber. This humor and sentiment, side by side with horrifying ugliness, is what makes his novels so distinctive. Dickens' novels are powerful because they accurately record the bleak conditions of Victorian England, and yet he always manages to bring hope and optimism to them. The settings of his various books have included grim prisons and factories, orphanages, workhouses, the streets of the slums, and even a bloody and violent revolution. He uncovers for us the cruelty and harshness of his era, but he always does so with wit, satire, and a sense of compassion for the underdog. Dickens created villains who were greedy, deceitful, and even sadistic, but he also created heroes and heroines who were honest and good, and who eventually rose above the moral decay that surrounded them. Many of Dickens' books were originally serialized. He wrote them in episodes, and one was published each month. This serialization is still apparent in his novels. Each chapter has its own climax, and characters are often reintroduced to remind readers of who they are. Pickwick Papers was his first novel, and the one that catapulted him to instant fame. Its first release, when he was 24 years old, numbered only 400 copies. Its fourth release, a short time later, numbered 40,000. Pickwick was written in serial form, like most of his early novels. Dickens was given only 2 days' notice to write the story, and he barely stayed ahead of his monthly deadlines, as was the case with most of his books. A clergyman of the time told a story about how he had spent an afternoon trying to provide spiritual comfort to a sick parishioner, and as he rose to leave and shut the door behind him, he heard the sick man say,
Well, thank God, Pickwick will be out in 10 days anyway.
Pickwick Papers is a very amusing book with a serious undercurrent about law and justice. From 1837 to 1839, when he was in his late 20s, Dickens wrote Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby. Oliver Twist, a work about the relationship between poverty and crime, was the very first book in the English language with a child as its hero. In 1840, when he was 28, Dickens started a weekly periodical in which he published, among other works, The Old Curiosity Shop, a popular story that later sold over 100,000 copies when released in book form. The demise of the heroine Little Nell at the end of the story caused a huge public response. When the last installment arrived by boat in New York City, 6,000 people showed up at the docks yelling tearfully to the sailors, "Is Little Nell dead?" Around this time, Dickens also began to write annual Christmas stories, the first of which became an enduring classic. A Christmas Carol is a perennial favorite and is still dramatized at schools and public theaters around the world. He modeled the miser in the story, Ebenezer Scrooge, partly after himself and his own obsession with money and security. A Christmas Carol was the story that gave us the phrase, the Christmas spirit. This spirit was so linked with Dickens that when he died, a little girl in London asked her father, "Dickens dead? Then will Father Christmas die too?" One of Dickens' special talents was his ability to see life through the point of view of a child, and he did so with unmatched sensitivity and insight in David Copperfield, which he wrote in 1850 when he was 38 years old. In the first half of the story, the hero is only a boy, and all we see and experience is filtered through his own innocent eyes. The entire book is written in the first person, as David, now a man, reflects on his life and the circumstances which formed his character. David Copperfield is the most autobiographical of any of Dickens' works. Many of the events in the story parallel events in Dickens' life, and some of the characters are drawn from characters he knew. In fact, by the end of the story, Copperfield has become a successful writer. In the process of describing Copperfield's life, Dickens also manages to become a social commentator and an energetic advocate of children's rights. The book includes descriptions of the worst abuses and inequities of his time: the rigid schools, child labor, debtors' prisons, unsanitary slums, and the general lack of respect and compassion for children, especially poor children. David Copperfield proved to be Dickens' most popular book, and there are more copies of it, both hardbound and paperback, than any of his other works. It was also the favorite work of the author himself. Charles Dickens wrote, "Of all the books, I like this the best. Like many fond parents, I have in my heart of hearts a favorite child, and his name is David Copperfield." It was Dickens' theory, perhaps not revolutionary today, but certainly debatable in the 1850s, that love was more conducive to growth and learning than fear. In another novel, Nicholas Nickleby, he vented his full fury on English schools and their soul-destroying cruelty. His attacks led to a parliamentary investigation and to the eventual closing of many of the worst schools. Charles Dickens is still known as one of the first crusaders for children's rights, urging gentleness and understanding in place of sharp discipline and the control of emotions so popular in Victorian England. As his life progressed, Dickens' concern for abused and exploited children became a passion. In 1852, Dickens released Bleak House, which described a corrupt judicial system. It isn't among his most popular works, but many critics consider it his masterpiece. That was followed a few years later by Little Dorrit, a story haunted by grim prison scenes. Then, in 1859, at the age of 47, he tried something new. This experiment in a new style was entitled A Tale of Two Cities, a story about the French Revolution. It has one of the most famous opening lines and one of the most famous closing lines in all of literature. It begins with, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And it ends with, "It is a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done." The story is part love story and part social history. It tells about the romance between the son of a French aristocrat and an English girl, and a young English barrister who sacrifices his life for their happiness. This drama develops against the backdrop of events that led to the Revolution, the heartless exploitation of the poor by French nobility, and the bloody and merciless vengeance those poor extract. In the actual style of A Tale of Two Cities, Dickens makes a departure from his previous works. For one thing, there are far fewer characters involved. Where David Copperfield had perhaps 20 to 30 significant players, A Tale of Two Cities has only a half dozen or so. That's because, unlike his previous novels, A Tale of Two Cities is focused on plot rather than character. And what a plot it is! More than one reader has stayed up all night with A Tale of Two Cities, unable to put it down until the story is resolved. When it is resolved, Dickens gives us one of the most memorable and heart-wrenching endings in the history of literature. Part of what makes A Tale of Two Cities so compelling, besides the story itself, is the strength with which Dickens evokes the atmosphere of the time. He vividly captures the tension, the raging emotions, the squalor of the streets, and the arrogance of the nobility. Another trait that separates A Tale of Two Cities from Dickens' other works is its lack of humor. Readers had come to love the comic characters and humorous incidents that distinguished his other books, and some were disappointed at the relentless seriousness of this novel. But that seriousness is appropriate to the mood and story, and strong humor would have seemed out of place. This demand for consistency is a burden many great writers have had to bear. Once the public becomes accustomed to a certain style, attempts by the writer to explore other styles and diversify his talents are seen as betrayal. A Tale of Two Cities was followed by Great Expectations, another story of a boy's coming of age. In writing Great Expectations, Dickens returned to many themes and styles that characterized his earlier works. In fact, it bears a strong resemblance to David Copperfield in both story and theme. They're the only two books Dickens wrote in the first person, from the point of view of the hero. In both stories, the narrator is a mature adult, looking back on his life, and particularly his childhood. In addition, the boys in both books are orphans, outcast from society, subject to the whims, kind or cruel, of those around them. And like most of his novels, A Tale of Two Cities being a notable exception, Great Expectations is a lengthy piece of work with an intricate, complex plot and dozens of characters whose lives interweave in a complicated series of events and coincidences. But what distinguishes this book from his earlier works, among other things, is that by the time Dickens wrote it, he was more mature himself. Great Expectations is a landmark in Dickens' career, because it's his most psychological book, the first book in which he was more focused on the internal workings of his characters than on plot. The motivations of the characters are far more complex and sophisticated, and many of his characters, not just the hero, experience an inner transformation. By the end of the book, they have changed. They've grown emotionally and spiritually from their sufferings. In 1865, at the age of 53, Dickens finished his last novel, Our Mutual Friend. He was working on another when he died 5 years later, called The Mystery of Edwin Drood. It was left uncompleted, the mystery unsolved. Dickens' books have endured for over a century. They still sell well, are widely taught in literature classes, and are often performed in modern dramatizations. He's also been an inspiration to many accomplished writers who followed him, among them Dostoevsky and Kafka. Those who met and knew Charles Dickens say he was a hearty, energetic man, but he was a sad man. As he grew older, he also grew more embittered and disillusioned. Life for Dickens was a series of disappointments. His childhood was marred by poverty and desertion. His first love rejected him. His long marriage was an unhappy one. He later felt let down by his children. And throughout, he was consumed by the gray bleakness and despair of life in the new industrial society. The pain Dickens felt as a child seemed to stay with him his entire life. Yet what is remarkable is how he took this pain and translated it into moving stories and novels that informed and entertained millions of people. In almost all those stories, there was optimism. There was unselfishness along with the greed, beauty along with ugliness, and kindness along with cruelty. He never allowed his sadness or despair to triumph over his hope. Remarkable, too, is the way he actively worked to solve the problems that so distressed him. While producing an enormous amount of writing, he also applied himself diligently to the social problems of London, volunteering his efforts for a number of causes and projects that benefited the poor and oppressed. Charles Dickens lived with disappointment, but he did all he could to assure that such disappointments would not be the lot of others and of the generations that would follow him.
This is the end of the session.